Blog Talk Radio.
Yo, what's up? This is Sana Cordia. I can't believe it. I'm back. Selena, can you hear me?
I can hear you, Sana Cordia. Thank you so much. Bon matin, home. Thank you.
Hey,
can you hear me?
No problem. I can hear you loud and clear. Can you hear me clear?
I hear you loud and clear.
Oh, great. When you get to do sound check, I'd like to thank you for pinch hitting here. I was stuck in the subway, New York City, Lenny Lenape territory. Can you believe it?
I know. You had me run the show, too, and then all of a sudden it turned off, and thank gosh you came to the rescue because I had no idea how to run it.
Well, I just showed up.
With that.
No problem. I showed up in the studio, and I see all these my boyas, and I'm like, wait a minute, hold on. Who said you can come in here? So I just called to leave. It's not like the movies, like The Exorcist. All you have to do is get out, and they run like hell, you know? They run
yes.
like hell. It's not like The
you
Exorcist. It's not like The Exorcist. So for all you people out there who are not familiar with the Maboyas, those are the negative entities that tend to show up once in a while, you know, and try to cause havoc in our lives in a Taino way. But all you have to do is see ya, and they run away really fast. So there you go. Now, that's why we're on, man.
Right, that's so, right. They couldn't stop us.
But before we go on, I got a good jingle for us. You ready for this?
I'm ready.
That's right. We cannot be denied, right? This is it, man.
That's
what do you
right.
think
We're
about
here.
That? Word. Hey, Selena, do me a favor. Since we got a little messed up, my desktop is not charged. Can you send out a
yeah.
word to Arayeke, Yukayek? Just send the word out that we're back on the air if they want to connect back, you know?
Already on it, as you see.
Because this is crazy what happened. So while you people out there, if you're listening out there, I'm going to put on a nice song just to set the mood. Once again, it's my old teacher, Edwin Cedeño. Great song. It's the Atabe song. That's right.
Atabera gua, gua bibi gua, uara bibi. Atabera gua, gua bibi gua, uara baba. Atabera gua, gua bibi gua, guakiana guti. Atabera gua. Suimako atamera wa wasuimako.
we go. That's Edwin Cedeno. Selena, you there?
I'm here.
Oh, man, thanks for putting out the message out there. If anything, you know, people can listen to this show in the future, as all shows are archived. Let me just share a little thing about Edwin Cedeno, if you don't mind, the late Edwin Cedeno. He was the teacher that taught me the Mayan Huacan, the Taino drum. And anyone that knew Edwin was a very talented man. Oh, my God. When it came to music, he was a master conga, bongo, rattle, percussionist. So when he started doing Taino music, he brought all his knowledge of rhythms, and he brought it to the Taino. And that song that you just heard, all the instruments are traditional instruments that he created, and he performed and mixed in the song. The guy was amazing. I was able to learn some of these rhythms. Unfortunately, he died young. You know, it was very sad. But hopefully his music continues on. He was very disciplined when he came to music. Very good man, very good man, Edwin Cedeno. So I always try to play his music. And that song is the Apare song he dedicated to. So Edwin Cedeno and his family, wherever you are, you know, much love to Edwin. And that was a true activist, I tell you. You know, Selena, because he put his heart and soul into the music and to the art. You know, the drums he made, it was amazing. He used to carve them himself. He researched the designs. And he really played those drums. What do you think? Can you hear it?
Yeah, I agree. You know, activism comes in all forms. And his music was a form of activism. And, you know, even though he has passed on, his music is still very much alive. So, therefore, he's alive with that as well.
Yeah, man. You know, I tell you a funny story. I used to spend weekends with him. He lived in Connecticut, and he was a diehard master. So, you know, one of these masters, you know, they're like the taskmaster, you know, got to get it right. You know, we always used to practice and so on. And he was like a martial artist drum teacher, you know, like, do it again, you know. And I remember I went to his house for the first time, and he loved snakes. He actually had an anaconda snake in his apartment in Connecticut. And it was growing really big. And
yeah.
Sometimes I used to go with him to the Audubon Society to get the rats, the frozen rats for the anaconda. And I'm like, bro, what are you doing, anaconda? How did it get here? So he used to have all these boa constrictors. He was big into snakes. And then one day he had a cage with a little animal inside. And I said, yo, what's this? It looks like a beaver. And actually it was one of those groundhogs. No, not groundhog, the prairie dogs out in the plains. They hide in these holes and they come up. And
mm-hmm.
It's almost like they're standing up. Oh, my God. He had a legitimate prairie dog. And then I says, oh, shoot, I love to pet it, you know. He's like, yeah, go ahead. He's cool, man. So I started to pet this prairie dog, right? All of a sudden, he almost bit my finger off. And I'm
I was
like,
just
screaming
say,
like,
pet it.
And I'm screaming, there's blood all over. I'm like, Edwin, chewing my finger off. So I snatched it out of desperation. It's like, oh, yeah, he likes to bite. Be careful. I'm like, what? So we got some bandages. I bandaged up my finger. I'm like, yo, should I go to the hospital? Nah, he's cool, man. He's cool. He's clean. And then he's like, come on, let's come practice. I'm like, it's like a kung fu training, man. You get bit by a prairie dog, and then you got to keep drumming for hours.
Yeah, you're like, hey.
Oh, my God. This was the Taino community like 20 years ago. You know, we just like, our heart was like now, you know, like everyone, you know, we want to do our best, right? We want to honor the ancestors.
Right.
I'm going to play this drum even though my finger is halfway off. I'm going to play. We have to honor the ancestors, you know. It was fun, man. I didn't need stitches, though, but That prairie dog got me good, man.
I bet. You know, it's interesting that he likes snakes. There's a lot of spiritual meanings behind snakes. So that's just interesting. Like, they're a symbol of death and rebirth, you know, because they transform, they change, they shed their skin. So some people see that as symbolism for rebirth. So that's interesting that he had snakes. I'm not sure about prairie dogs, but the snake, I've
think
heard that before.
I think that that a symbol of how to bite a finger really fast without getting caught.
Yeah, well, you're not going to find me petting one of them anytime soon, so.
Oh, my God. No, but now you mentioned about snakes. You know, our Taino ancestors, they honored the snake as a atabe, because the snake was the closest to the earth. It depended on the soil to move. So that was a symbol. Our ancestors used to carve these really beautiful snakes. So there's actually one in the museums. It's awesome. So I think it's in Dominican Republic. Let me go check. Maybe I'll put that photo on the websites and Arayeke websites. But it's a really cool snake. I don't know if you've seen it. But let me see if I look for it as we talk. Right, it's like a branch. It's like from a branch or something. They polished it. Really beautiful, you know. So activism. This is our man. It's been a month since Taino Radio's been on the air. We've been doing a lot of research. We're trying to bring some awareness of what is, or who is Arayeke Yukayek, right? So you want to share with the crowd, millions of fans that are tuning in right now, what is Arayeke Yukayek? Who is Arayeke Yukayek?
Well, there's a lot of things to say about who we are, but Arayeke Yukayek is a indigenous Caribbean nation. We are composed of individuals and families from the Greater Antilles Islands. One thing that I found once I joined Arayeke Yukayek is that our community provides a safe space for all of us to learn our indigenous culture, and there's a lot of preservation and education and a lot of outreach. Cacique personally had reached out to me about Arayeke Yukayek, and there's a lot of honor in the spiritual traditions as well. You know, we're a big community, a big family. There's just so much that could generalize terms, you know. We're a nation composed of people from the Greater Antilles Islands. So that would be the Bahamas, Puerto Rico, Cuba, Dominican Republic, and Haiti. So, you know, we're a big family. That's the best term I can think of in my head. I just think of us not as really a group, just a family, a community. That's, in my opinion, what I think that you could to be about.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of freaky. I think I match like maybe 75% of everyone in the group when it comes to DNA. But was that at least 75%?
Yeah.
But,
All of us are related to Cacique as well.
Well, I think it's 100%. That's freaky.
Yeah, that's the crazy part. She was showing us how to do GEDmatch and upload our DNA results. Because we don't really care about DNA and stuff like that, but we did it because we're interested to see, maybe we're genetically related as well. So when we did that, it was pretty crazy to find out that, I'm related to my cacique. It's from my mother's side. But, yeah, mostly all of us are related to her and to you as well. So that is just, like, I don't know if that's ancestral work or what. That is just incredible. Not only is it genetic ties, there's familial ties, which is quite incredible. It is.
Well, that's activism work right there, when you help people figure out their matches, DNA, how they could connect to other relatives. That's activism right there. We didn't have that thing.
That's right. Activism comes in all forms. And then, like, most recently, you know, when Stephanie, she's one of our tribal members, she did the petition to stop Christie's, you know, a lot of us came together to do that, and not just from our Yukayeke, but others as well. You know, that's activism, and that's ancestors as well, coming together for a greater cause.
You know, before we get to the Christie's part, let me just say that, you know, in the northern tribes here in America, U.S., one of the requirements of federal recognition is you have to prove your lineage in that tribe, you know, the relations, relatives, and you have to show that genealogy that people are related. And a lot of northern tribes do have those records. We unfortunately don't because, you know, those invaders, they did a good job destroying records and not keeping records.
Yeah, we keep genocide.
Right, of the indigenous. They call us white, blanco, or they call us all these different things, but indigenous. So, and sometimes they messed up on the records and they put Indio. You know, they screwed up. Or maybe there was an activist out there who says, you know what, I gotta do the right thing. But, yeah, man, so we're proving, we're using the latest technology, right, that we are relatives.
Right.
That we do belong to this tribe. And I just want to let people know out there, maybe you're part of another Yukayeke or community, whatever. You know, you're welcome with us. We have open registry for everyone. Since we're a Taino Nation, everyone's welcome.
Yep,
it's important you check
welcome.
With your – what's that?
Oh, I was saying
yeah,
I
we have
yeah,
we have open enrollment. And the reason why we have that, because of this DNA. You know, I have a lot of friends. Well, my relatives, and they're not in any Yukayeke, or they're in different Yukayekes, you know, we tell them, come on in, man. We, you know, this is for everyone. And that's the key. So let's go to Christie's. That was another example of activism. And what was your experience during that time period? That was back in November, early November, I believe, these auctions in Paris. Uh-huh.
My experience, it wasn't just my – I feel like we all felt this up and down of emotions. You know, we were very excited and very hopeful. You know, we had – when Stephanie first made the petition, we just had five signatures, you know, just five. But to us, that's like, you know, oh my goodness, like people are seeing this. This is incredible. And then I believe we got like over 50,000 signatures and – to know that the Taino people, not even just Taino people, allies from all over as well, just to know that their voices were not heard is truly heartbreaking. We all watched that auction, and when we saw our, you know, people say artifacts, but, you know, beings, they're beings, they're semi. Seeing them being off for profit, I'm trying not to cry. It's just, I still feel this emotion. It was really heartbreaking. I remember, you know, talking to Jasenia. We were just heartbroken. We all were, you know, seeing that we had this petition. We even had allies in Paris as well, who were doing live feed, just seeing the semi being put in dusty boxes. Just knowing that they went into hands of those who aren't educated on Taino culture, have any respect, just knowing that they're going to sit there and just, you know, in a glass case in a home that's not even, that doesn't belong to them. That's just truly freaking. So it was a lot of wave of emotions, but this isn't the end. For us, it's like, you know, we're going to keep on trying. And that's, you know, hence the GoFundMe that we have. But the reasons for the GoFundMe that we made is to have a cultural center to house our sacred beings, that their special homes, that's where they belong. They belong home.
Definitely, definitely. You know, there's many museums throughout the world. I believe France is the number one museum with the most artifacts. But maybe, I mean, as a museum, and then we have the Smithsonian, they have over 55,000 pieces. Different pieces, pottery, semis, you name it. So they did generously give the bones of some ancestors from Cuba. They gave it to Cacique Panchito back in the mid-2000s, and they did a reburial ceremony. So, you know, he has a community. He has land. So he was able to do that. Yeah, he was able to do that. So this is he set the precedent for all of us.
Yeah, I'm so grateful that he was able to do that, you know, and I can't even imagine the emotions that they felt finally having their ancestors' bones and, you know, in their hands. And, you know, and some of things that I've read and learned, you know, our ancestors would actually put bones up in a gourd and hang them up on bohíos or, you know, or the cané, which is where the cacique was, where they'd have ceremonies, you know, so... It's just, it's very important. Like, I just feel like the people who have our objects who are not Taíno, just, I wish they would become educated. I wish they would do the right thing and return them, even without not having land. You know, just doing the right thing.
Well, one of the things that many tribes up in the north do is when they hear about their sacred objects, they advocate, you know, they reach out to the institutions or auctions, and they try to retrieve that item, and it's very difficult. There's no respect out there, you know, on these sacred objects, and it's sad. But I know we did it. I did a show here, two shows on that same day on the Christie's auction, and I was very emotional. I felt like someone came into my house, tie my kids, and I couldn't do anything. You know, I was helpless while they just ransacked the whole house and just took what they wanted. That's how it felt. You know what's crazy? Remember when it hit the mallet? Bam! Like so, bam!
That
was like the worst sound. Right?
Just hearing it, just knowing that it was finalized, it was like, just felt like I was just getting hammered down into the ground deeper and deeper. That for me was just seeing that. It wasn't just me that felt that way, a lot. It was huge.
Yeah, man. That hearing that mallet just like drove me nuts, man. It was like, what? You know, this can't happen. You know, he's so angry, and France is so far. You know, he's like, you can't walk there. But our good brother there from who was there in Paris, young artist, he advocated and he protested that day. That was amazing how he protested. Let me just go back. And the police were very hostile with that. That was, hold on a second. That's on November 10th, the breaking news episode. That was kind of powerful. And that was with Vanga. That's the young artist out there. He's going for his master's degree, Vanga. And he shared his experience there, but said the police were all over the place. And they were very threatened. Imagine they felt threatened.
They were. Someone who, because I would reshare what he was sharing, because he was live, you know, he was recording it. It was just him and another woman. They were standing out there alone. But they were, you know, they were doing that. And someone who, you know, speaks French, they translated, and they were saying that the police were asking for their ID, their address, and they were being very, you know, hostile, and they were just standing there, you know, protesting. They weren't doing anything, right. So I was very upset at how they were treated by the French police, that there was no reason for all that.
Yeah. It was cool. When we did the ceremony in New York, you know, I've been a lot of protesting since the 90s, and it's always the same scenario. The police come. They have to do their job. They have to ask the questions. Sometimes they get a little forceful. But once you explain what the deal is, they always have that look in their eyes, like, oh, you know. And I always love that look when they give. Like, okay. And then they always look at the people who complain, like, yeah, nothing going on here. They're honoring their culture, you know. It's like, and this happened in Christie's when all the security came out and they brought this sergeant. Oh, we're doing a native ceremony. It's protected by law. We're in the U.S., the U.N. You know, Yokahu sent me, real small. He said, that's it. Nothing threatening about him. He's our, you know, he's the guidance. He's our guide. We're here to revere and also remember what's going on in France right now. And they left us alone. They left us alone. They kept watching us, the security, but they left us alone. So that was kind of cool. So that was a good highlight. This is the first time that, you know, in front of Christy that we did that. But it was like, oh, man, that's a great feeling, you know. We're honoring those ancestors, right? And,
mm-hmm.
and you know,
and
we didn't break any law.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a beautiful ceremony that all held.
Yeah, definitely. And one thing that was beautiful that day, it was a nice day. You know, people respect it. And just having Yokahu Bagua Manoko staring at Christie's, it was like giving a stare down, you know. So I made sure it faced Christie's there in New York, giving that stare down, you know, like, yeah, man, I got my back up here. That was us, right? So it's just amazing that the last rebellion was 1511 to 1519, the last major push towards the Spaniards. And here we are, right? 2021, we're still rebellion. We're still fighting the good cause, right? Isn't that an amazing feeling, though? What do you think about that?
Yeah,
529 years later, right?
Yep. Yeah, it's an amazing feeling. And I know that the ancestors are looking down at all of us in absolute pride, you know. We do this because we weren't able to. You know, we're learning our language, our culture, because they were not able to do that.
Right.
It's kind of like ancestral healing, generational healing, you know. When we do this, we're not only healing ourselves, but we're healing our generation in the future and our ancestors from the past.
Right, exactly. Exactly. You know, I just want to open up the lines later in a couple of minutes. If you want to call in, any folks out there in Arayeke, Yukayek, or any other Yukayekes, or anyone listening, phone number is 515-602-9792. That's 515-602-9792. It's been over a month. We're back on the air. We're going to have many different shows. We're going to have a show on history. Taino history. We're going to start with the rebellion of 1511. I promise to have that show soon. We're going to start giving some. We're going to start giving some historical context to those original rebels, right? Rebels of a cause, right? And
revolution.
Yeah, it's very important. So we're going to have a history show. We definitely have to keep on with the activism show because the battle has just begun. The battle has just begun. It never stopped, right?
Right.
You know, I just want to let you, tell me.
Oh, no, speaking of which, earlier in the show before it got caught off for some reason, I had mentioned some of the topics we were going to discuss today about Yukayekes here and, like, back then and now. I know just some people are interested in that, how they were back then and then now in the 21st century.
Beautiful, exactly, man. So let's keep it rolling. Let's go. I know that's kind of what the tradition kind of contrasting with 21st century, right?
Right.
Well, as not many people know, Taino culture started around 900-1000 Common Era, or AD, and it came to a kind of, I won't say a halt, but there was a little interruption in 1492, you know, but that wasn't not too long of a period, right, when you consider history, but a lot was completed during that time period. And it kind of built upon the Salidoy people before them that came from South America. Before the Salidoys, it was the Mayans. You know a little bit about that, right? The Mayan people.
Yep. Yeah, that's even better than being Taino and Mayan, that they, you know, a lot of that culture and stuff was exchanged, that they communicated with one another. It's incredible.
Yeah. You got the Mayans from Central America. Then you got those different influences from Mexico, Mexica land, Aztecs. You know, they all came down. Those Mayans, they came down from the north, and they came to the Caribbean. Then you have the South Americans, right, from the Amazonian basin, and you got the Andean people that came up. And, wow, that's a lot of indigenous cultures that provided information, provided culture, agricultural knowledge, navigation knowledge, and it all exploded, right? Became the Taino culture. So I guess, you know, that's our tradition, right? You know, people
right.
to this day, they still, yeah, they still grow the yuca like they did, you know, 3,000-4,000 years ago. Same technology.
Yep.
That waning moon can't grow yuca at any time. No other time but during the waning moon. You know, the rainy season, late April, the farmers still follow that. The fishing techniques. Fishing. You know what's cool? I know I was reading that they used to have, farm the fish in the rivers, and they used to put these sticks, like, what do you call those? Barriers or cages?
Mm-hmm.
They used to cage certain fish.
It's
and,
like a trap.
Yeah, they used to do these traps and stuff. And they always have fresh food. That's the thing. They have the Hutia farms. The only thing is a lot of people don't like is that they used to eat the small mute dog. It was a dog that was mute, and they used to eat that. They used to farm them for food. But the bigger dog for, I guess, hunting and stuff. But you know, there's a lot of ancient cultures that they – huh? Tell me.
Oh, no, I said I was just thinking, since you mentioned the dogs and the Caribbean that were, you know, native there – it was interesting because I read somewhere that those dogs were essentially mute. They didn't bark.
Yeah,
I didn't know if
there
was any truth behind that or not. Wow.
Yeah. I remember talking to Yare Melende, Dr. Yare Melende. One day she showed me a dog that had like these zebra stripes, but it was black and rust color. And she was showing me a dog that was really small. And said, look, that's that dog. They did DNA on these dogs, and they definitely are related to the mute dog. And they're really small. And they look kind of weird, too. They don't look like a regular dog. And I'm like, yeah, you know, they have DNA. These dogs, they have to. I'm like, wow, that's deep, man, you know? That dog's, their DNA still exists now, you know?
That's incredible.
So, yeah, I saw them. They're really small. And they're really quiet. See, they still have those characteristics of that mute, you know. They do bark, but they're very quiet. They don't make much noise.
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't like them because they like dogs with noise. What?
Oh, I mean, the fact that they're mute, it would be beneficial to our ancestors then, you know. You know, since they're mute, they could sneak up on prey.
Oh. There you go. Yeah. And then the children, they used to hunt. They used to hunt the parrots. They used to hunt the turtle, you know. And I mean, not the turtles. They used to hunt the pigeons. Pigeons, too, they used to hunt the kids. So everyone had a job, you know. It's the traditional lifestyle was definitely, you know, they had to keep the species alive, the community alive. So there was always plenty of work. And it wasn't like going into a supermarket, right? There's a lot of work to be done. Yeah. Oh, what a lot of people don't understand, too, is that the women were the ones that were master artists. It was the woman that did the art. So Christie's, you know, they put a lot of value in our art. But that was carved by the women. Can you believe that? The women, there was nonstop supersonic designs with no drills, no bits. No laser pointer. You know, it's like, this is amazing how they did all this work. Organically, right?
Right.
So that's all cool.
You know,
I'm trying to think of what else. Yeah, tell me.
Oh, no, just referencing what you were saying earlier, just about agriculture-wise. You know, back then, you know, they had canucos and stuff, but even now and today, in the 21st century, you know, in Borinquen that I can speak of, they still have farming land. They still have canucos because they rely on that just because food and stuff extremely expensive. So I know at least my abuela, when she lived there, that she had her own farming field. So that was just something interesting. I think that it still was back then with her ancestors, but it's still, you know, here today in the 21st century.
Definitely. You know, when I spend my time in Nahuake, Dr. Yaya used to take me to the farms. And one of the things I remember, she took me to this grandmother, and she was the expert corn planter, you know. And they planted corn. And I remember seeing the corns hanging from the house as they were drying. And that was going to be for the feed, I think, for the animals. It was different areas on the land that was different, was going to be for the corn, you know, the way they process it. Kind of interesting, you know. It was like, wow, this is like straight out of North America, native, you know, with the corn.
Mm-hmm.
And they had their own technique, which is amazing. I'm trying to think about. Then, of course, the yuca, the batata. You know, batata was the main farming nutritionist food that it was farmed. The yautía, you know, which was that, it's like a sweet root. And then came the batata, which actually comes from South America, the Andean people, that sweet potato. Then what do you call it? The yuca was for the bread. Which I think you made, right? You made the yuca bread, right?
Yeah, so I recently learned how to make cassave bread, you know, because with some of the yuca, you have to be very careful because, you know, like our ancestors, they used a sibukan to extract the liquid from the yuca because it was super poisonous. It could actually, about ingesting the yuca juice could cause cyanide poisoning. It degenerates your cells. It kills your cells. So they recognize that. So I didn't have a sibukan, but I used a very thin, what do you call it, like a hand towel. So when I went ahead, you know, when I did the cheese grater to go, I peeled the yuca, I washed it, and then I grated it with the cheese grater by hand. I'm sure there's easier ways, but for some reason, I just kind of, you know, our ancestors, you know how hard it is to do that. So I felt connected in that sense. So I just went ahead and, you know, kind of strained it like that, put it in there, and then twisted the hand towel and strained it, and I cooked it. And I made it as an offering to our ancestors, and it was just incredible to eat something that they ate, and we still eat today. So
it was just a really experience. Well, it's interesting. I live in a Dominican community here in Washington Heights, New York City. And the minute you go into the supermarkets in this area, you see cassava bread. That's the first thing you see when you go in the supermarket, cassava bread. It's still being used now. Which leads to the next question: how 21st century? How does the Taino live, or how should we live? What do you think?
How the Taino lived, you know, they, like I said earlier, that they had farming fields, they had conucos, you know, and in Taino society, then, you know, men, women, and children, they had roles to play. And that included, like, based on status. You know, the way they lived, I wish we still lived that way. They didn't charge. They didn't have, like, currency back then, you know, like we do now. They would give food to other yukayekes, and, you know, they would do this on their own. They would pass this down, children and so forth. Again, they're still doing that today. They still have their farming fields and stuff, and they rely on that. There are differences, however, like, you know, before 1492, you know, our people lived in bohíos. We were naked. You know, that was normal. There was nothing wrong with that. That was normal. They believed when they were born, that's how you should be. The societal structure was different, you know. But in today, you know, we have a lot of us on ancestral lands. Some are in other areas of the world. You know, it's so different. But I do believe we could go back to that. We could go back to producing our own food to feed our people. Food is a human right. No one should ever have to go hungry. And our ancestors, you know, they didn't believe in that either. They believed, like, everybody should eat to go back
right.
to that.
So what do you think is the transition from now? How should we live, you think? Just thinking out loud, 21st century, how do we keep, you know, how can other people see us and say, oh, yeah, that's Taino people right there? You know, like how does that look, you know?
So,
or is it totally different now?
I think it really depends on a person's mindset and their willingness to be educated and to learn. I know on social media, I try to incorporate the Taino people, us, you know, because we're very much still here, very much still alive and thriving. You know, words such as batasa, that's Taino. So I'm like, you know, or like barbacoa, I'm like, oh, you're having a barbecue. Guess what? You know, that's Taino origins. And
right.
kind of educating people on that and what it means to have a barbecue and how it was done. It interests people. I would like to see that happen. Is it realistic?
Mm-hmm.
I think anything is realistic if you put your mind to it. But how we live now is definitely different. I feel like the world is kind of consumed by money, and, you know, we have a lot of electronics and technology that wasn't
right.
back then. And although technology can be beneficial, it's also detrimental as well. So there's some pros and cons to that. I think it'd be kind of great if we can combine both, like the way back then and the way now, kind of meet in the middle. But I just think that the way that our ancestors lived back then, I would love to see now, not just with Tainos, just in the world as a whole.
Right.
You know, because, you know, we're all on Native American land, you know, North America, Central America, South America, and the Caribbean. This is Native land. agriculture came from Native American and then was incorporated
mm-hmm.
into European culture and so forth. You know, a lot of things that people are doing, they don't realize originated with the Native. So if they can kind of, you know, take that and adopt that, I think they could adopt going back to the way our ancestors
yeah.
lived. I think it's possible.
You know, I remember this many years ago, I was when I was a Franciscan, I used to speak to a lot of the missionaries that traveled throughout South America, Japan, and so on. And I always used to ask them when, you know, let me change that. I used to speak to the retired missionaries. They used to be retired. They were older, and we used to visit them at their retirement place. And I always used to ask them, hey, so what's the best place you've been to, you know? And most of them used to tell me, are you Puerto Rican? I'm like, yeah, you know. Oh, Puerto Rico was the best. Because they used to send the friars to Puerto Rico to learn Spanish back in the 50s and 60s and stuff. And that was the place to go to learn Spanish. And then they'll go wherever, you know, South America, whatever. And they all would tell me, oh, man, I'll never forget Puerto Rico. Everyone's so hospitable. Everywhere I went, they wanted to feed me. They wanted to give me drink. It was a party every day, you know, and they felt like family, you know. And different friars will tell me this, even though it's different conversations. And these friars have been around the world, Japan, you know, Europe. And they will always say that little small island. And there was some that went to DR. And they will say the same things, very similar, like about the hospitality, you know, that they felt. They didn't feel like strangers. They didn't feel like gringos, you know. They were welcome. And I'm telling you, that still exists to this day. You know?
It does.
Forget the crime, forget all this poverty and stuff. I'm telling you, the hospitality, and that's what Columbus wrote. That's the first thing he wrote. These people are so hospitable. You know, with one sword, you could tame a whole village, right?
Yeah.
See?
Yeah.
And this is what I tell people constantly, you know, and that's our first quality that we have to treasure, that we have to keep it. It's hospitality, you know, to share, right? It's to
exactly.
share what we have, you know. You know, back in the day, you know, in the Taino movement, you know how we used to judge people if they were Taino? Take a wild guess how we used to judge. How many stuff they used to give away. You know?
Really, dude?
That was always the dynamic we used to judge. Like, this fake. Say someone comes to my apartment, whatever, I'll be like, oh, man, I got something for you. Oh, I got this. Then you go to someone else, like, oh, man, look, I got this, and I want to give it to you. You know, it was always like wherever we went, we always, like, left with something, you know. It was like, and then if we went to someone's house and didn't give us anything, I'm at, yo, that ain't thing, you know. Right? we used to say that, like, oh, man, that dude ain't thing, you know what I mean? He's posing, man. It was funny.
You know,
man. We were crazy back then.
So, like, especially with Caribbean people, it's like that. You know, that's how my will is. That's how my mom is. Especially my mom. This is the kindest person you will ever meet, with the biggest heart. She doesn't shake your hand. She'll come in with a hug. She'll make sure you're fed. She'll give you things even if you don't want them. I've noticed that, and that is a part of our essence that has been passed down from generation. Generations, our loudness and our fierceness. You know, people say, you know, Boricuas, they're so loud. Like, I mean, we are, but we are loud and we're proud. Like, you know, our qualities and stuff. Those have been passed down. Our words, Taino words, our food, our music. I mean, so much is incorporated in today's society.
Okay, how about this? It's two things. Think of any culture. One of our two public ceremonies that we practiced back in the day, the two most sacred ceremonies was the batu game, and that's a sport. If you look at it now, it's a sport. And the ajereto, that's when they did the dancing and the teachings. It was always dancing, it was eating, it was drinking. Two of the most public sacred events, right, ceremonies. It was surrounded with dance, food, right? And then you have a sport, you know. So think about that. That's freaking amazing. A sport, the batu game, is a sacred ceremony. You know, right now, we spend all this money on tickets to go to baseball, football, right? Hockey.
Right.
For us, that was a sacred event. Think about it, man, right? The mindset.
It wasn't just like, oh, who's going to win? It was like, it was a sacred ceremony. They were in ceremony as they played about they, you know, about who, you know, it was sacred. And interestingly enough, which I already know, Pocatok is very similar, which is a Mesoamerican sacred ball game as well. And it's very similar to about they. So it was sacred. It was held in the same way. I was thinking about that actually a couple of days ago.
There you
crazy.
Go.
We picked these events, but this was sacred. This was ceremony. So
de la Casas, Bartolomé de la Casas, who spent most of his life with our people, he will write how, you know, men marry men versus marry women, you know, single women versus married women versus virgins, you know. It's like, it's the sport, man, like, to have fun. Sacred means fun. And our ancestors knew about that, you know. So sometimes, you know, I go to this, I'm not criticizing anyone. Forgive me if I sound like it, but, you know, I go to a lot of these ceremonies now. It's so solemn and, you know, got to follow these protocols, you know. What happened to the fun? Right? So, you know, I always put that in ceremonies. You have to have fun.
You
People
do.
Have to laugh. People got to smile, you know.
Yeah.
This is
that's the essence
it. We have
of
to,
it, you know.
Huh?
No, that's the essence of it. You do that in your ceremonies. You make everybody feel comfortable. We have fun. And, you know, you're laughing, you're smiling. Like, you know, it's just, that's how it should be. It should be like a family gathering. That's what it should be. That's what it should feel like. While, you know, thinking about, you know, our stories and everything like that, that's what it should be about. I know some, you know, there's protocols out there, but for us, you know, we're just very, very laid back, very accepting of everybody, which that's what I love about us. Our Yukayek, we're just so accepting of everybody. It doesn't matter where you come from, who you are. We love you. We want you to come and look and teach us, you know, let's exchange information. Yeah. Let's learn. Let's grow together. Let's build bridges. It's what I love.
And we kind of look down on colorism, you know. It's not about if you look Amazonian or if you look like this, you look like that. It's all right, you know. We're relatives.
And I like to tell people that Tainos, even back then, just referring to our ancestors, just because I'm talking in past tense here, they weren't just pure Taino. Like, they mixed with other indigenous groups around them as well. And our ancestors didn't care about trivial things such as physical appearances or blood. They didn't have the science to determine. You know, that's a very much a colonizer's opinion, you know. I know a lot of people care about the blood quantum, but we just use it to see if we're family. It's just interesting to see if we're connected. That's it, you know. I feel like we open arms. But, yeah, you're right. We don't care about that. We come in all shades, and that's what makes us beautiful. It is absolutely beautiful, you know, because we do, you know, some might look like the Taino that you think and then some don't, but that doesn't negate their indigeneity. They're just as indigenous as the next person.
No, no. You know, one of my teachers, Irving Sings Good Stewart, I always want to mention him. He's a very holy man, very good man. He was a peyote leader. He was also a sun dancer and a sweat lodge leader, and I went to his house, and on his wall, he had photos of his genealogy kind of thing. It was really impressive up until it was like that transition after the reservation, you know, when reservations were active. They had these photos, and then hey, you see that guy right there? I'm like, yeah, it's kind of interesting, man. Yeah, he was French. I'm like, what? He was a trapper. And he married my great-grandmother. He fell in love with a crow, so he was adopted once he married my great-grandmother, and I have his name, Stuart, you know? But he was so proud of that, you know? He was, like, so proud. So he was, you know, they laughing, he's telling me stories that he heard, you know, it's like, I guess they used to tease him a lot for being a trapper from France, you know? But, you know, they accepted him in the tribe. Now it's part of his bloodline. And he was so proud. You know, he was so proud. I'm like, look at that. You know? You know, so many people are ashamed. And I admit sometimes, you know, on my worst day, I'll be like, oh, damn Spanish blood, you know? But
I promise you're not the only one who's felt that.
So he kind of taught me a lesson, you know, like, you know, we're quick to judge, but, you know, we don't know the story of that Spaniard, you know, or that Portuguese guy who married into the family. You know what I mean? So, you know.
I think it's better to use that energy to focus it on something more positive.
Exactly.
To help, you know, grow yourself.
Yeah, definitely. You know what's nice? Wasn't it interesting talking about hospitality? This is a Crow Nation back in Montana. When I first was introduced to Irving, my wife at the time and also his wife, we went to visit him. We had to rent a car. He was way out by the plains. He used to have a ranch, you know. And what happened was, he says, I'm sorry. And listen, they're in the 80s, okay? And the first thing they did, check this out. Ready for this?
First
thing they told us. They greeted us and said, oh, you must be Lewis. And then she was like, yeah. He said, well, we want to apologize. I was like, why? He says, you know, in our tradition, we have to feed you. We have to give you a good feed. That's what he called it, you know. But, you know, we're older and we kind of don't cook much anymore, you know. And I was like all embarrassed by my God. And it's like, so we're going to take you out to eat. So they took us to a diner. And they fed us anything you want. Real country, you know, he's talking stuff. So we went to a little dive somewhere, you know, a little diner. And I was like, oh, my God. This is our Caribbean. We're alike. We do the same thing. When someone comes over first time, you got to feed them, right?
Right, and yeah.
So I asked him about that, about this tradition. He said, oh, yeah, yeah. You have to feed. First meeting, you always have to feed. And you continue to feed. It never stops. So, yeah. And then he has some gifts for us. He has some little gifts, some trinkets. He went to a, oh, it's so funny. He went to, like, this flea market, you know. And he's like, oh, no, a pawn store he went to. And he bought some trinkets. It was the best thing. I was like, wow. You can tell there was rush because they just told him, like, that same day, the morning. And but he made an effort. His 84-year-old man made the effort to keep that tradition alive. When you meet a stranger, you got to gift them. Which, you know, and it's like, wow. I was blown away by that. So I always tell, you know, we're all related, right? This is the things we have to do.
That's right.
So people, right? The indigenous values we got to keep on. And we're doing it. We're doing it.
We are.
So I just want to tell people out there, if you don't look Indian or you don't talk Indian, whatever that means, if you, you know, watch your YouTube videos or movies, it's all right, man. It's how you act. That's the true activism, right? The true activists will walk what they talk, right? It's that actions. Wow. That's the actions. And this is why indigenous culture is so unique, right, in the world.
Right.
You know? Like, what are our acts? Like, what's... Okay, we talk about hospitality. We can agree on that, right? But but what else stands out? And then also, you know, the farming. But what else stands out that makes us uniquely indigenous? Let's brainstorm a little here.
I can say for me personally, I've always had an open mind. I've always been accepting of everyone and everybody. Despite my mom's like that too, and so is my abuela. I'm not sure if that's an indigenous quality or just taking people in with open arms. Despite, you know, like I feel like I just noticed it with just me, it's just other people as well, you know, other indigenous communities as well. I had a friend, and Their family is from Mexico, and she is very much like that, Greek arms, absolutely. Wow. You know, and they're indigenous as well. I don't know if that's really an indigenous quality or not, but I've only noticed it really with indigenous people. I'm sure everybody could be that way, but it seems like it's come naturally with some of the indigenous people I've met.
Yeah, definitely. Then the whole thing about teasing, too, how, you know, instead of embarrassing someone, making them feel bad, you know, you tease them, you know, make a good laugh out of it. So, you know, you don't reprimand anyone.
I just thought of an indigenous thing that, like, I do this, my mom does it, like, lip pointing. Like, if you're trying to point at something, do you do that with your lips? Like, you're pointing over there? That's, like, you know, an indigenous thing I've noticed within our community.
Hey, we just recently talking about that. I think La Loca Lisa Suarez was talking about. We were talking about that, about sign language. Sign language.
Is it really sign? That's incredible. I had no idea. I just thought of that. Like I do it, and it's not just like us, you know, from the Caribbean. I'm seeing other indigenous groups do it as well. And I just felt like that's something we've had in common to, like, okay, I'm pointing over there, you know, like, I don't know. It's like an instinctive thing you do. So is that, does that count as business quality?
Can I tell you something right now?
Sure.
At the same exact discussion with Irving, because I was at dinner, another occasion, and people are pointing like crazy. They don't talk. They just point with their lips or you know, do something with their fingers, you know. Then no one talks. Like, can you please pass the salt? No, it's like you jerk your head or point whatever, you know. I'm like, Irwin, yo, why people do the same thing? Like, no one says anything. You just point or whatever. He's like, oh, yeah, it's Indian sign language. You know, he made a joke out of it. I said, well, we do that, too. I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. It's Indian sign language. And then he's showing me some of the sign language they use, that they still use, you know. And I was kind of understanding it, too. It was crazy. It's like, what? You know. And he said one day there was a Mexican man that came to the res looking for work, you know. And he knew some of the sign. He was using sign language. So, you know, as far as Mexico, they still have those sign language techniques. You know?
Oh,
so
yeah.
It was interesting, man.
Oh, no, I was just saying, in Mexico, you know, they have a huge indigenous population.
Well, it's all,
they do.
It's all
so
indigenous, right?
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 Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Man, I tell you, Mexico is awesome, and they have so many traditions there. Oh, my God. You know, the great Aztecs,
really,
and the Mayan, the Mexicas. It's, you know, each province, you know, has their own unique. That's another thing about indigenous peoples, bro. We all look the same kind of, or we act the same, but we're all uniquely different, you know. We have our own traditions, creation stories, the way we, you know, ceremonies, talk different language, you know.
Yeah. And that's like
Did you just hear us? We said at the same time. That's another thing. That,
yeah.
You just said it at the same time.
I'm around you too much.
Causing all this.
Yeah. It just reminds me of, like, how we need to decolonize our history, because I feel that there's a lot of people out there, when they think of indigenous people, Native American people, they clump us all together in one. And there's been couple of us had to educate people, you know, the Taino are not the same as the Crow Nation. They're not the same as the Sioux. You know, we are very different. You know, although we all come from Turtle Island, our cultures are unique in its own way, and that's what makes us absolutely beautiful. That just reminded me, you know, that's another thing I feel like, you know, is a big thing, just not knowing that we're not all the same, but we're the same, but we're different, kind of getting what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You know, it's funny, I have this old book in the Indigenous Library. It's called Rethinking Columbus. It was the very first print. It was printed in, I'm looking at the pages now. It was printed in 1996. There's a second volume to this called Rethinking Columbus. And one of our elders in our community, Jose Barrero, he wrote an article in this book. It's called The Taino Men of the Good, translating it at the time, how the Spaniards translated it, Men of the Good. I guess inclusively you say people of the good, you know. So this is what he wrote. I'm reading a little bit about what he wrote here, okay? Let me see how we're doing in time. Hold on a second. Don't want the show to cut us off again, right?
Yeah.
Okay, we got some time.
I know, I felt so terrible about that.
What's going on, Ray?
I know.
Okay. So let me see if I read this. It's kind of cool. It says, the Taino world of 1492 was a thriving place. The Taino Islands supported large populations that had existed in an environment of Carib-Taino conflict for, according to archaeological evidence, perhaps the 1500 years, although the earliest human fossil in the region is dated at 15,000 years. Tainos and Caribs may have fought one another, but there is little evidence to support any notion that they tried to wipe each other out through warfare. A Carib war party arrived and attacked, was successful or beaten back, and the Tainos, from all accounts, returned to what they were doing before the attack. Early descriptions of Taino life at contact, tell of large concentrations, strings of 100 or more villages of 500 to 1,000 people. And these concentrations of people in coastal areas and river deltas were apparently well-fed by nature harvesting an agricultural production system whose primary value was that all of the people had the right to eat. Everyone in the society had a food or other goods producing task. Even the highly esteemed caciques, community leaders, and the mejiques, medicine people, were often seen to plant, hunt, and fish among their people. Taino culture, as with many natural world cultures of the Americas, the concept was that the primary bounties of the earth, particularly those that humans eat, are to be produced in cooperation and shared. Now he goes on to say, the Taino enjoy a peaceful way of life that modern anthropologists now call ecosystematic. And in the wake of recent scientific revelations about the cost of high-impact technologies upon the natural world, a culture such as the Taino that would feed several million people without permanently wearing down its surroundings might command higher respect. I'm going to skip to the end. Among the few Taino Arawak customs that have survived, the predominant ideas are that ancestors should be properly greeted by the living humans at certain times, and that natural forces and the spirits behind each group of food and medicinal plants and useful animals should be appreciated in ceremony. It's kind of an interesting article. Wish I could read the whole thing, but kind of summarizes what we're talking about, right? About the food.
That's beautiful. And if you can send that to me, I would really appreciate it. Oh,
yeah, I have
I
to scan
you know
it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We do have a caller on the line who's from Ariek Yukiek that would like to speak. She just has a question, if we do have time.
All right,
for that.
Let's hear it. Okay, hold on a second. Let me get on my let's get on the switch here. I mean, not the switch. What am I talking about? That's the other program, Switch, right? let me see if I can access this here. I'm having a little problems. When you use it, it kind of... Wait, what's causing all this? Hold on a second. Hold on. Hey, where's the intern? The intern's not here. What happened to the intern? Studios.
I had trouble figuring it out, too.
There you go. Where's the intern? Okay. Okay, let's see. Let's see who this mysterious caller is. From the mountains.
Hello?
Of the unknown region. Who's this?
It's Stephanie. Stephanie.
Wait
Bog.
A minute. Hold
Hi,
on
Stephanie.
A second. Is this the Stephanie Bosch from Arayeke Yukayek,
yes.
Or is this an imposter? Huh?
No, not imposter. This is V1.
All right. Welcome to the show, man. Ask away. What's your question? It's an honor.
Yeah, I had some questions regarding some stuff you guys were talking about earlier. So I know we were talking about, or you guys were talking about, like, what can we do in today's modern times to honor the traditions of our ancestors and practice them as
right.
well in today's time
right.
and day and era, as well as keeping society itself modern, but also embracing the culture and the tradition.
Word.
So I know Selena had mentioned it earlier, which is something I've been talking about for months now, and I was the whole entire time, I was like, yes, han, yes, this is exactly what I'm talking about. and I know we discussed it in a meeting, I think, like last week, about the possibilities
right.
of, instead of using currency, using what the practices our ancestors did, which was trading and sharing and not just amongst our own people, our own Yucayeque, but also amongst other people and other Yucayeques. So that was an idea that I've had for a very long time, because it's just something that I felt spiritually connected to, that money is not a money all my life has played no monetary purpose for me. It's just it's something that gets me by in life, but it's not something that I feel I need to survive. And it's right. been that way my entire life. I'm going to be 32 years old in 2022. And to have that mentality for all these years before even having the knowledge of ancestry and where I come from, that tells me a lot about where we come from spiritually and how we're connected still to our ancestors.
Nice.
And to hear that other members of the community have the same mindset, that says a lot. It's not just one person or two people who are thinking this way. It's many. So if we're all thinking this way, and we have this mindset, maybe we could have a talk about it at some point of discussing, and maybe an araito of what maybe we can incorporate the practices of our ancestors in today's time without feeling like we're reverting too much and not being modern. I don't know, because I know we were talking about the nudity and how our people didn't wear clothing, which that's not an issue for me, but in today's time and era, you know, people have an issue with public nudity. So, you know, that's maybe something, you know, because it's
hey,
wait,
a children's
today's
show
here. Time.
It's a children's show. What are you? It's a children's show. Hold on.
It's a children's show. That's why it's a nudity. They came out this one speaking too. That's not that word. But to practice that kind of practice that, you know, that our ancestors did, like the ceremonies and the rituals and the medicinal practices as well, and the arts and everything, we could do that today in today's time without feeling like, oh, we're too colonized still. We could still be decolonized and practice what they did. But, you know, in modern times, we could be fully clothed and still do the same thing. We don't need to rely on so much on technology and how do I say, society's norm, because nature is what's normal.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well,
so I wanted to put that input in there.
Oh, that's pretty good. I loved it. I love it.
I also wanted to touch base on the Hobisi. I don't know if I'm saying it right. Hobisi.
Hobisi?
Or the Hobisi. They're the mute dogs from Puerto Rico.
Oh, okay, yes. We were talking about that earlier.
Yeah, so I don't know what is the reason why that they're not liked today, but from what I learned about them was that they were actually used for hunting, which Selena mentioned that earlier. They were used to hunt because of their muteness. So they were used in that sense of, yes, they were the Taino's best friend or their domesticated pet or however way you wanted to look at it, as well as parrots. Mm-hmm. But both parrots and the Hobisi were used for hunting purposes as well as for when they were protecting themselves. The parrots and the Hobisi would be the ones to alert the indigenous people of, hey, something's here or someone's here, and they will relay the messages to the Taínos.
Okay, our my intern is not here, so I'm looking in the archives myself, but I know I just recently read something the opposite of what you're saying, so I got to get on that. So hold on.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to talk about it, because I'm like, I read something opposite. Like, I've heard about them, but I read it differently, so I wanted to discuss that.
Who was your source on that? Maybe I know the author.
I
love
that. I
could pull it up for you right now. Hold on. It's a website called 19CanimalArchives.wordpress.com. I can actually
and what's their
share
source?
It in the group later on the link.
And what's their source?
But it was a post that was posted back in April 5th of 2013 regarding the exact animal we're talking about.
Okay, this is... Okay, I found something here. I was just reading on this. Hold on a second. This is The Daily Life of the Taino People. It was written by Marcio Veloz Maclio. This is from a book called Taino Culture. Taino, Pre-Columbian Art and Culture from the Caribbean. This is what he wrote. Hold on a second. Dog breeding for food and hunting purposes was an important Taino activity. The small breed, the so-called mute dog, appears to have been part of the diet of some Taino groups, as remains have been found in garbage dumps along with evidence of food leftovers. A larger canine species was crucial for hunting jutia, a large nocturnal rodent that was captured after being flushed by fire out of his forest habitat. There you go. So they found this small breed. They found it in the, you know, where they used to dump the loot, food leftovers. We call them garbage dumps.
Yeah.
Of the smaller breed. And the larger canine was for hunting, jutia. Kind of.
The larger canine, I believe, was called the alcos.
Mm-hmm. And it was used to hunt jutia. So it's kind of opposite of what these people said, right? Huh?
Yeah, is that actually quite very much the opposite? But maybe from what they were determining, like depicting of the the reference to the dog, is that since you just mentioned there was two types of dogs, maybe perhaps
yeah,
they were talking about the hunter in the aspect without really acknowledging the one that was used for feeding.
Yeah, the smaller one was for food. They farmed for the diet. The larger one was for the hunt jutia. And jutia was also part of the diet. Yeah. Now this guy's
mm-hmm.
pretty credible. This writer. Hold on a second. He gives a lot of sources.
Is it
there. One of the big sources?
The source
is
that
the
I was just reading from was from that archive that I was telling you about, but the source is called, their name is Caridian Anches.
Mm. But what are they quoting from? Like, what are their sources? Is it archaeology or?
Oh.
Like, who are they quoting?
The sources, I see, in the bottom. Sorry. I'm reading from the phone. That's why. I'm not really good at the technology thing.
Oh, no problem, because, you know, that's important.
No.
The sources.
Nope, that's not the sources. I think I should just share it to Selena because maybe that'll be easier. She could help me.
Yeah, because it's important.
You, you and I can look over
because,
it together.
Yeah, because in this source here, they're saying that they found it through archaeology. All these digs. You know?
Yeah, I just shared it now.
Okay,
I got
so we'll
it.
Look
I just
it
got
up,
it.
Man.
Got it, got it. So, yeah, I wanted to talk about that as well, but you guys were also talking about fishing.
Yeah, the fishing. Fishing was very important, yeah.
Yeah, so you were mentioning about the way they would fish and the way they farmed the fish, and
uh-huh.
I used to describe that as the netting that they used as the volleyball courts and the tennis court and, nets. Because that's exactly what it looks like to me, or the way I depict them.
You know what's cool? There's people by the town of Ceiba, that they actually fish in a traditional way, and they use those nets.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw this grandfather had the biggest net I ever seen in my life, and he was using it all by himself, and he was getting fish all day, you know, to sell. Sardines and bigger than sardines and the bigger fish in his net. I learned how to do it. They put these weights on them, and if you don't
mm-hmm.
open your mouth in time, by the time you throw the net, if your mouth is not open at the same time, you're losing your teeth.
Yep.
And, it was an art. It was an art in itself looking for those fish. But it was amazing. It was fun the whole day. So I won't say how much beer we drank that day, but was that?
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. The line is a little breaky, like disconnecting on my end, so I didn't know you were still speaking.
No. The only thing I just said was that, but I won't reveal how much beer we drank that day, but that's another story, yes.
They're children.
Oh, wait a minute. Put the children away. Hold on. Thank you for reminding me.
No problem. What I was going to say was that I remember when I was little, living in Miami, my father used to take us fishing all the time. And one time he got frustrated with me because I was notorious for losing my fishing rod into the water.
Oh, wow.
I would cast my rod and just, like, let it go completely without holding on tightly for it, so it'll just completely go. So one time my aunt came on one of the fishing trips with us, and I did not know this about her till recently because I found pictures of my aunt, and they're all Tainos, and they're all part of Yucayec. I didn't know this.
Nice.
So when I was younger and my aunt came on that trip, she said, hey, you don't need a rod. She was like, I will show you how to fish without a rod. And she taught me how to fish that way. And I actually was catching more fish that way than using a rod.
Yes.
Awesome.
They still use that in Puerto Rico. They still do that in Puerto Rico. I don't know about DR, but I know in PR they use that. A lot of rod. I tried it. It was fun.
Yep.
I didn't get anything.
It is fun.
A lot of people were getting it. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one thing I learned, too, you know, I keep getting upset because I was trying to get the fish out of the net, and some of them got caught, and it was like, I don't know, I was like kind of a rookie. And it felt like, what do you call that? It's so icky, you know, when you touch the fish and they're fighting you. So a couple of times I let the fish fall in the, I forget what you call that. It was like the bridge made out of wood we were standing on. And it got stuck on there. It would get stuck in between the planks. And I'd be like, oh, man, I feel bad for the fish because it's going to rot, you know. Hold on a second. Yeah, it was going to rot. And then the guy that was teaching me said, don't worry about it. It was Ita. He said, don't worry about it. Nothing is wasted in the ocean. Nothing is wasted. And two minutes after he said that, I just saw all these crabs kind of coming out of nowhere, like a horror movie. And they didn't bother us. They just went straight to the fish that was caught in between the planks. Oh, damn. These fish just totally took the fish. Crabs just totally took the fish, you know? So nothing is wasted. That was beautiful.
That is beautiful.
I have a question, because you guys were talking, now that we're talking about fishing and the way that they hunted, our ancestors hunted, earlier you guys were talking about, like, different Taino words and how barbacoa and barbecue, well, barbecue derives from barbacoa, which is the Taino word. But, I remember it was being discussed. I think it was Cacique who mentioned it, that our people didn't have game to hunt in that way. So I wanted to know what exactly were they barbecuing, if that makes sense, because if they didn't have big game like cows, pigs, and stuff like that to hunt, what did they barbecue?
Lizards.
Fish.
The fish. Yeah. Octopus. All that good stuff. Conch. Or
conch,
if they say lambi.
Mm-hmm. Like the way that we do barbecue a lot of times is completely different than how the Tainos did it, you know. They would have like this frame that would support the framework where the food is placed so it wasn't reached by animals, and they would put the food over the fire.
Over a fire?
Yep.
And you know what's cool?
Like a little
campfire
with like sticks or whatever, they'll just manually rotate it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
And you know, what I learned when I was visiting Nahuake territory up in the mountains? Every house had a modern oven or stove, right? But in the back of the house or in the yard or whatever, they had the fogon. They had the barbecue. You know, traditional barbecue with the wood and all that. I'm like, oh, damn, this is straight out of a history book, you know? And these things were old, like passed down generations, you know? That just blew me away. I'm like, what? The official no lying, legit fogons or where they did the barbecue, you know? And all these
and
houses
so
had them.
It's interesting that you say that. Because it's that very essence, that very practice that the Taínos did and modern day Taínos slash Boricuas do is we're being referred to as jíbaros and jíbaras for doing that very thing.
Yep.
See, that's what my abuela said. We came
and not understand how that insulting.
Wait, say that again.
I think it's just something.
Oh, I don't understand that. How is that considered an insult?
Oh, yeah. If you say, that's what I call jíbara, like, you know, backward. You know, that's not modern. That's some ancient stuff, you know. They always use it as a, you know, as an insult kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know?
I was talking to mom about that, and she says that they use it for, like, as an insult for country people that aren't educated and stuff when it's not true. My abuela said that we are Jíbaro, like we came from the Jíbaro, the people in the mountains. And because she didn't know what Taíno meant, like she didn't know what Taíno meant. So I told her that's like the word that we use for like people who are indígena. And she's like, oh, okay. Because she says, oh, you know, we're Indian. That's what my abuela says. Yeah, we're Indian and stuff. But it can be used in a derogative way.
Oh, man. Yeah, especially if you're a little awkward or something in the family. They call you, mira, te jíbaro. Or if you're not very social, you know, they say, mira, te jíbaro. You know, so it's still used to this day. It's kind of sad, you know. It's part of that colonial mentality, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's used as a way of saying, oh, a person's a wild person. They're from the mountains. Like, they're a wild person. Like, una jíbara is a wild woman from the mountains.
Uneducated.
So that's uneducated, no knowledge of society, like what society is doing.
You know, it's interesting. I remember when I was up in that community, they taught us never to promise something you can't never promise someone if you can't give it to them. You know, that's like the word. Your word is gold. Up in the mountains, you know, you never promise something you can't deliver. That's it. You know, because if you say something, they're going to remind you, you know, because they hold you by your word. And that's an indigenous, you know, that's a big indigenous value all throughout. It's the word. Your word is gold. It means it's valuable. So those Jíbaro communities, you know, those indigenous communities up in the mountains, that's the thing. So they were warners, you know, never promise, because they're going to let you know, they're going to remind you, and if you don't give it, they're going to think you're a liar, and they won't talk to you, you know? So that's kind of interesting about cultural, you know, as indigenous people, our word, you know? So if you're kind of a person who likes to gossip, likes to put other people down, that's not kind of, it's not look, you know, you're not that role model, or you're not that, you know, your anti-community, you know, that's the thing that we have to consider, you know, as we're trying to not restore, because Taino culture never died, but it's continuing that tradition, right?
I like that word too. To continue.
Yeah,
I like that too. Instead of saying reviving or restoring, the continuance is.
Yeah.
I feel like it's more accurate than saying to revive or restore something that's been here already.
Yeah, that's why I would never. Man, That's why I was never happy with that whole title they gave to the Taino movement, revitalization and stuff. Because it's like, wait a minute, what are we reviving? It never died. You know? It looks different.
Exactly.
And it looks different today. But we got to focus on those values, right? Like we talk about today, those values. So,
speaking of
values,
evolved.
Huh?
You know, indigenous culture evolves as time goes. You know, like I think a lot of people, when they think of indigenous people, they think, you know, the stereotypical indigenous person, but we're simply indigenous, you know, me, you, Stephanie,
mm-hmm.
right now, you know, it changes with time.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the key that for all of us is values. What was valuable
mm-hmm.
in 1000 CE, right? That was valuable to the indigenous in 500, right, CE.
I feel the valuable thing that's been valuable the most is our voice. Like you mentioned earlier how a lot of people like to talk about how Puerto Ricans and Boricuas in general are
mm-hmm.
loud and,
mm-hmm.
and they're just so loud all the time and et cetera, et cetera. Even comedians. I saw a comedian skit of Gabriel Iglesias, I think his name is.
Yeah,
and he did a skit making fun of Puerto Ricans, saying, I don't understand why your kids always got to be so loud and say announcing that, oh, soy Boricua, we already
right.
know why you got to make an announcement every time. And I thought that was insulting because how are you going to continue trying to silence us when we've been silent for so long? That's our power. Our voice is our power. So yeah, we're gonna announce whenever we go. Soy Boricua. I'm here. Ya tu sabes.
Yep.
Like, because
yeah.
why am I gonna keep being oppressed?
That's right.
And that's
yeah.
what I find very insulting. But that's our power. That's the value. That's the value we share.
That's it. That's it. It's important that we again, the values, that's the key, you know. Like,
yeah.
We may not, you know, this is the thing also, like, we don't have to dress like we're straight out of 1492. If you want to, it's cool, you know. If you want to perform in schools or in cultural events, that's all cool, man, you know. But what are the values that we can apply every day, right, in our jobs, in our families? Man, that's the challenge, right? And right now, I just want to remind everyone who's listening right now, you listeners out there, thanks for tuning in. Thanks for downloading the show. But there's a GoFundMe account right now, campaign, that Arayeke Yukayek is supporting. We're fighting for it. It was started by Stephanie Sherman. It's a continuation of the Christie's auction fight. And that is, we're trying to build a cultural center in the homeland in which we can bring back those sacred beings back, right? To restore the dignity of our ancestral sacred beings, ceremonial items. Again, we stick up for our ancestors. That's another value, right? We stick up for them. We honor them. So I don't know about you guys, but it's hard to sleep at night when we know these things. These our secret beings are in the museums. They're in some Smithsonian drawer, right? Waiting for us.
Yeah, for sure. I know I haven't been sleeping well at all. Like, I was up for like all night up until like 4 in the morning. Then I fell asleep to 6 in the morning to wake up at 6. And stay up till 10 to go right back to sleep and wake up at 12. And that's been my sleep pattern for quite some time now, especially ever since discovering confirming my ancestry as well as being affiliated and trying to fight for our ancestors' tools, ancestral tools that they use for ceremony and rituals. So, like, this has been something that's been, like, not just bothering me during my sleep, but it's even during the day, like, having stomach problems and appetite issues. So it is something that's spiritually connected to us. It's affecting us
spiritually, not only emotionally and mentally, but affecting us physically and spiritually.
Yeah. You know, wow, we're almost on the second hour. We're almost, I just want to wrap up. But I have a quote. I'd like to hear your impressions on this. He's not a very popular historical figure in our history, but he wrote something. He was an eyewitness to our ancestors, right, a traditional way. And this was documented in December 25th, okay? And it was written by Christopher Columbus. Let's see what he writes. The Santa Maria hits rocks off Española. Columbus is forced to abandon it. The Taino cacique Guacanacari weeps when he hears of the shipwreck. Taínos help unload the ship without the loss of a shoestring. They are, Columbus writes, a people so full of love and without greed. And I believe there is no better race or better land in the world. Written in December 25th. What do you guys think about that?
Hearing that quote now and knowing what's happened in history is just, it's heartbreaking because how he talks about, if you read a lot of his entries, the way he talks about the Taínos and the islands, he's got a very fantasized view. A lot of it is, I can't think of the word, it's like overdramatic. He even wrote that the Taino people had tails, which is absolutely not true. It's heartbreaking because he doesn't see them as people. He sees them as objects that he can use. He's not talking about them as human beings. So hearing that is heartbreaking.
This is the very beginning. This is like the honeymoon stage, right? I mean, I don't think he's exaggerating here. He said they're full of love and without greed. I can agree with that. What happened? Selena?
Sorry, I wanted to put my input on there.
Okay, Selena.
Oh, no.
Was that Selena talking?
Go ahead.
No, it's Stephanie.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I got confused.
It's okay. Maybe it's because we're cousins. We sound so much alike.
Yeah, I know, right? All these cousins, what's going on here?
Right? when you read that out loud to me, to everyone, when you just read that out loud, it actually brought me back to, like, when I was learning about Christopher Columbus in public school. And learning about it and hearing what you're sharing, it's like it all makes sense now that you know the truth. But even back then, I questioned what I was being taught because it made no sense to me. I'm like, that's not true. And something about what you're teaching me is not right. And I would literally fail these classes because I would go against what was being taught to me. And now that I know the actual truth of what Christopher Columbus did and who he was, it's like what you just said now, to me, it sounded more like he was viewing us as, oh, this is perfect. I came across this beautiful land with many riches and in many ways, and these people are so kind and so humble and so naive, I could use them. And that's how I perceived what you said. But yes, he was admiring our traits, and he was saying that, but not in the aspect of saying, oh, yeah, they were great people, yes, beautiful people, but not because of the way we see them. He was seeing it as, oh, they're perfect, too. We could take over this land without a problem because they're naive.
Right, right. Well, here's the thing.
Because, you know, the whole point of the trip was to find land, you know.
Well, that's the thing is
exactly.
We started getting to know. Well, once they figure out there was gold, that's it. It was out the window, right? You know, I'm looking at hold on a second, why I can't find it. Where's the intern? I went home early. Oh, my God. Okay, here we go. Okay, this is an excerpt from 500 Nations, an illustrated history of the North American Indians. we can conclude with this as a food for thought and, you know, thoughts for how to build an indigenous community. Let me see. Hold on. There was a, hold on a second. Okay, fighting defensively, Enrique instructed his men to kill Spaniards only in the course of a battle, otherwise simply to deprive them of their arms. And on one occasion, he even spared Valenzuela's life. It was said that Enrique never slept at night and himself patrolled the village until every dawn. For 14 years, Enrique and his Arawak supporters fought the Spaniards to a standstill. There was one Spaniard to whom Enrique was still taught, and that was the priest, La Casas. La Casas, who would become known as the protector of the Indians, met with Enrique in his mountain stronghold. Hold on a second. 2 months later, the two men appeared before the Spanish authorities and negotiated a truce. The Spaniards agreed to Enrique's terms, the guaranteed freedom of all the remaining Arawak people, and there were few of them left. Of all the millions who had inhabited the island in 1492, only handful survived. In Hispaniola, 4,000 Arawaks remained to follow Enrique to a settlement at the base of the Cibao Mountains. Now, Enrique is the famous Taino leader, who was the chief Guarocuya. He was the grand nephew of Alacaona, Cacica Alacaona. So, what do you guys think about that before we conclude? He negotiated a truce after 14 years of fighting the Spaniards right in Haiti, Quisqueya.
Is he the one that they refer to as the betrayer?
Betrayer? No.
I wanted to know because there I know there was a Taino warrior that they called the betrayer or something like that,
mm-hmm.
because he gave up the people to the Spaniards.
No, that wasn't him.
No.
He was a grand nephew of Alacaona in Caunabo. And what happened after Caunabo died in the sea? They were trying to take him to Spain. And he died in the sea after a storm. They invited Alacaona and many of her people, her leaders, in the Yucayeque, and the Spanish burned the house down. She survived, and they hung her in the plaza. And Guarocuya survived. And after they killed everyone, he survived, and he was raised by Spaniard missionaries. He was 10 years old. Up until adulthood. And the encomiendo leader, or I should say the slave plantation leader, Valenzuela, he actually raped, they call him Enrique, or Enriquillo, little Enrique. He raped his wife. And because Enrique was educated, right, he went to the court to complain. He went to complain and says, my master rape my wife. And the judge was like, well, what do you want me to do? You don't have rights. You know? You're not a Spaniard. And that's when he started the rebellion. It lasted 14 years. But check this out. 14 years, at the end, they had a truce and they gave them freedom. You know, and that's the history that we need to understand, that the Spaniards did give our people their freedom, you know. So we have to honor that. We have to honor that treaty, you know. We have to remind each other that we fought for that. We got that freedom. So what do we do with that? What do we do with that?
It's kind of sucks that we've been put in that position. You know, that the Spaniards could feel like that they could mm-hmm. choose whether we have freedom or not. Even though that's the truth, you know, the history is just, it's heartbreaking.
It is very heartbreaking, but we could also use it as a constant reminder
of what had happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of cool because in history they're saying that when they found out about the rebellion, all the chiefs that remain as servants to the landowner, the landlord, they all left. They all left looking for Enriquillo. You know, Enriquillo, they were looking for him to join the rebellion, you know. And they met up in the Cibao Mountains. And then Enriquillo, very smart man, he had the village chiefs assist him in making sure the women and children, the old people, were put in caves high in the mountains in case they lost the war, you know. So that's where they kept the children, the old people. And there they raise chickens. They have vegetation plots to feed the army, you know. 14 years, man. A lot of people don't know that. 14 years. And at the end, the Spanish said, okay, we give you your freedom. So we have that right, man, as indigenous people right now. We just have to say Enriquillo or Cacique did it for us, you know.
Guadalupe.
Yeah. But, you know, we have to remember these stories, you know. We have to. So the United States of America asked us, what right do you have to be an indigenous tribal sovereignty? Oh, that's easy. Guadalupe gave us our freedom, you know. I believe to this day the only nation that acknowledges that treaty is Canada, believe it or not. So, but it's an official truce, official treaty with the Spaniards. So we can use that. We can tell the U.S. government, you know, this is our legacy. This is our history. We fought our freedom. Our ancestors fought for our freedom.
That's what I was saying. That's what I was trying to say when I was saying, like, we could use that as a reminder.
That's
like,
it.
In today.
It's
like,
legitimate.
Don't forget, this happened, mm-hmm. okay? Like, I'm reminding you.
mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, this is a legitimate. Hold on a second. See the time here. It's a legitimate treaty, you know. Actually, it's the original treaty, the first treaty ever, a Taino nation with.
I was gonna say, wasn't
that
the first treaty of the Taino people?
That's it, right there. So we can use
say,
that in a court
of
law.
That was the very first treaty. I believe you were just talking about it.
Yeah, that's it. That was it. We have to honor that, man, and we have to really. Teach that to all our people, that this, we got our freedom. You know, we got our freedom. I mean, in Morinque and Cacique Humacao, he had a battle, wiped out a soldier of Spaniards. He took his people 4 days. They went to Enyunque, never to be seen again. But they live up those mountains, you know. So, you know, this is the legacy that we inherit. So we cannot be afraid but proud, right? Tribal.
Maybe that's why
sovereignty.
We're so loud. Maybe it's because of the treaty. The treaty was how we found our
yeah.
voice again, to remind people, yeah. hey, ya tú sabes, we are here, and we're not lost, yeah. we're not forgotten, we're not extinct, we are here, and
yeah.
we're free.
Yeah.
We're not oppressed, and we refuse to be oppressed.
That's it. So all you Arayeke, Yucayeke people are listening, all you Taino from other Yucayekes who are listening, we have this heritage. We have this is like our inheritance, right, that we did win our freedom. That's an official document, you know, we did it. So
that's our gold.
That's it. So that's our claim. Wherever land we go, whatever land we buy, we just GoFundMe, whatever. We can say this is our inheritance, you know. So hopefully that can give us ammunition, right? As true activists, right? Enriquillo, he was active. That's that whole activism, you know. Our call to activism is definitely, you know, land back. That's it. Let's unite families, you know. Let's unite the families. Enriquillo did it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So guys, man, we're running. We're out of time. We're overtime, 7 minutes. We're at the 2 hour. 2 hours. Can you believe this? That's another thing about Taínos, man. We don't stop.
I forgot.
Right? Sure. Huh?
I forgot we were doing laundry. So comfortable conversating.
Yeah, Stephanie's fault. You know what's going on?
Yeah, it was my fault.
No, you had excellent questions, though, for real. You did.
How
I appreciate that.
So you know what?
And I appreciate you guys allowing me to speak today. I really appreciate that.
No, man, it's all good.
Of course.
Just sorry we didn't have any beverages or something, like Mali or something, you know. Next time, right? Yeah, virtual.
Yeah.
You know, I'm looking for a song. It was written by Ika Mateo from the Dominican Republic, Isqueya. It was written, dedicated to Ana Caona, the great female chief.
I love that song. Exactly the song you're talking about. I love it.
But you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, I use it on a lot of my TikTok videos. Mm-hmm.
Oh, where? Whenever I mention Ana Caona, I always play this song. So, all right, I think
the song
this
I play when I hear Ana Caona is called Ana O, Ana O by Enrique Cardena. I don't know if you've heard him.
Enrique Cardena? Oh, yeah, I heard that. Yeah. I don't think I have that song, though.
Yeah, it's a very beautiful piece.
All right, so in the memory of Ana Caona, because, you know, a whole rebellion started with her, her grand nephew kept it going. So we'll end the show. Thank you, ladies, for being here. It's been real. It was fun.
Thank you.
So in the memory of Ana Caona, Enriquillo, our claim to the land continues. Take it away, Ica Mateo.